This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You might think the trade war affects manufacturing aluminum and electronics, but it's a lot more than that for one Bloomington business owner.
Luggage in itself is a 17.6% tariff. The government in July added another 10% onto that.
Kristen Ray tells Fealty's Mary Cullen her prices are soaring because of tariffs. Plus, cooking for five presidents presents unique challenges. Correspondent Joe Deacon chats with a White House chef. GLT's beer correspondent, well, okay, that's not really a position, even though it ought to be, but Ryan Denham previews a new Fairbury brewery. And the Coalescence Theater Project gets some national recognition. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One Bloomington Normal small business owner is calling out the Trump administration on the trade war. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Kristen Ray, owner of Inspire Travel Luggage. Ray says she started her e-commerce business in 2013, but as tariffs increase, her hesitation grows.
You know, a lot of sourcing happens from Asia, from China, not just because of prices. You know, I think that that is a misconception. You know, it's really where a lot of things are manufactured. You're finding your raw materials and being able to kind of source those before you go into a production queue. So, you know, I think that the way that we need to look at, you know, how things are marketed globally, you know, is where we can kind of find things that fit in. So, you know, while my target market is, you know, families and people with kids maybe who are traveling, you know, beauty buffs who like to take all their products with them, they also kind of have a max that they're willing to pay for something. So for a brand like myself who doesn't really, you know, do a ton of high volume at certain times, you know, I have to be able to purchase inventory. I have to be able to retail it at a certain price. And I'm a small brand, so funding is a part of that. You know, you wish you could, like, walk into the bank, you say you have the best idea, and have them give you, like, $1 million. And it doesn't really work like that. So, you know, you kind of have to work with what you've got. And when I first started, I tried to be an American-made brand. I reached out to a lot of larger manufacturers here in the country, and I was just too small. You know, they didn't want to work with a startup like mine. So, you know, I had to be able to figure out how to make my brand work. And that was going to a part of the world where it was easier to do business. You know, a lot of those factories, they're just smaller operations. They're people too. You know, they have families. And those are the first people who really kind of helped me, you know, build this brand up. That is a loyalty that, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, is earned. You know, they definitely have, you know, the processes down there. Where here in the U.S., for startup small brands, it's really disconnected and almost impossible.
Now, you mentioned purchasing these raw materials. What's your experience been like with the recent tariffs?
So, you know, as you purchase raw materials in another country and then you bring it in, you're bringing them as a finished product. So that's where these tariffs have come into place. You know, when you bring things in, it is a tariff by category. So in July of last year, luggage was added. You know, luggage isn't a matter of national security. It's a code. It's a category. And the administration really kind of went through with a axe and, you know, started cutting apart, you know, what it looks like, you know, to bring products in. And so they just blanket picked certain categories to receive that increase. Luggage in itself is a 17.6% tariff. The government in July added another 10% onto that. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, what is your tariff and how it's applied, that 27% is applied to the commercial value of what you're bringing in. So, you know, it's like a sales tax, but it's applied, you know, when things reach customs. Those are paid by American importers. They are not paid by China. China is not in the luggage business. They're not the importer of record. It is nowhere on that paperwork when it hits the border and customs takes that tax. And that's a misconception that has been been put around. So I'm really glad that I have the opportunity today to dispel that. I am the importer of record. Inspire Travel Luggage is paying those increases. And unfortunately, you know, for smaller brands and niche brands like mine, you know, we don't have the opportunity to just eat that 10%. You know, that's a huge part of your profit margin. And, you know, to have the government not recognize the businesses who are bringing products in and making a living, it is tough.
And now you were just saying you're the one who has to take on that cost. What's that changing for you?
So I haven't brought anything over since November. At that time, there was not because my other brand is loungewear, so it's kind of pajamas. Those were not on the schedule for increases, so I was able to bring it in its regular tariff rate. I'm relaunching a collection of luggage here, you know, this year, and it very well will destroy my existing supply chain. 27.6% is a lot of money. For every $45,000 worth of merchandise I import, it's almost $13,000 extra. So that $45,000, the cost of goods becomes 58, and then you're trying to kind of fit that into your profit margins and how that kind of works. So when you get into those big numbers, it's pretty significant. If you're trying to borrow money and $45,000 does it for you, you're going to need to come up with another $13,000 just to get it here, you know, across the border. That's your tariff bill. That's your tax bill, and that's pretty significant.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Kristen Ray, founder and owner of Inspire Travel Luggage. Now, Kristen, let's switch to your wholesale prices. What are you seeing on that front?
I don't do a ton of wholesale business, but what it does to your product cost is it really kind of adds to that. So if you were more in the wholesale business and you were selling to other businesses that then would retail, it's completely changing that. Wholesale, you make a little bit less than what you do if you were to retail it. So I'm assuming that a lot of other brands, you know, like mine, smaller brands who do a lot of wholesale business, they're really hurting. And that's taking away their profit margins.
And have your prices for just the everyday consumer gone up as well?
So, like I said, you know, I haven't brought anything in that has had this extra increase. But what I am going through now to figure out the pricing for this newest collection, you know, I've had to add the full 27.6% in, and it has changed. It's really changed where, you know, when I first started, you know, the bags had a certain MSRP that has changed now. You know, having to add that extra money is not something I want to do. It definitely does change, you know, maybe who can afford to buy my products. And I think that that's tough for every small producer because you want to stay competitive. You know, how you buy merchandise from manufacturers is your price is based on your volume. So if you can't go into it buying as much as you can to get that unit price down, you're kind of already behind the eight ball when you know, it comes to really retailing. But if you're a good brand and you have loyal customers and you run a good business, sometimes, you know, those increases maybe aren't felt, but it does have unintended consequences.
How long do you think your business can hold up?
So, you know, I have to pass on that extra tariff in my MSRP to survive. You know, otherwise you're taking 10% of what would be maybe, you know, to stay competitive, maybe you only had 25% margin. You know, it's really eating into that. So I, unfortunately, like pretty much every other retailer in the country, is raising their prices. That is how the government has structured this. Our president is going out and saying that China is paying these tariffs like it is, you know, we're punishing China, and that is not true. It is an American importer who is paying that tax bill. If you know anything about international manufacturing, your manufacturer will say, you know, here's your product, here's the price, it's FOB, free on board to Hong Kong or Shanghai. That's when you take possession of it. Your freight forwarder then brings it over, and that's when, you know, you run into customs and pay your tariff. So, you know, the president is wrong. I think that he has an agenda for saying it that way. But what the problem is that people like me, smaller importers and brands, are suffering because of it, because the truth is not being told.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Kristen Ray of Inspire Travel Luggage.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new entry into the craft beer scene in central Illinois. Ryan Denham has more. It's crunch time in Springfield, and the Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at progress toward a budget. This week, Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse reporter Daisy Contreras, Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, and Rebecca Ensel, Capital News, Illinois. Mackey says with 2 weeks left in the spring session, the governor has a lot of ideas he wants included in the budget.
Well, we're closer, and it seems like it's going to be an easier job because, as we talked about last week, there was this April surprise, $1.5 billion in tax payments that Illinois had not anticipated. People are projecting, the governor's office at least is projecting, that some of that bounty will continue into next year, giving them a little more money to play with. But exactly what to do with that money and whether it obviates the need for any other new money coming in is really the political divide. You had Republicans this week, as they did last week, claiming that you could sort of toss out Governor Pritzker's proposal to impose a tax on plastic bags. You could scrap the idea to triple or at least raise the cigarette tax and impose a tax on vaping and all the sorts of things that the Governor Pritzker wanted to do in terms of creating new taxes or raising existing taxes. Republicans say, you don't have to do that. Please, let's get back to negotiating on this. But Democrats are saying, wait a minute. You know, one, we have the supermajority, but, you know, we're happy to negotiate, but they don't really ultimately have to, probably. On the other hand, they're saying that, you know, yes, this is great that we have this bounty, but it's a one-time thing. We're not sure it's going to continue. We still think we need additional revenue to do all the things we want to do, like fix DCFS, as we heard Majority Leader Greg Harris saying at the top of the show.
Well, Brian, you mentioned the Republicans talking about negotiations. They are in what is known as the super minority, meaning that Democrats could override a governor's veto with just Democratic votes. They have enough of that in both chambers. But Republicans, are they sitting there basically just on the sidelines right now, or are they in some type of talks with the governor and other legislative leaders?
Well, as far as we know, there had been these working groups, right? House Democrats. So the governor, the way the budget works, the governor gives his big speech that happened in February. Then the various legislative committees, the appropriations committees, hear testimony from all the agency directors, state universities, people like that, about what their spending priorities are. And as we understand it, the House Democrats started from a rather austere place. I've heard they assume no revenue growth, really, and none of these new taxes, and put together a pretty brutal budget that would have involved cutting across state government. Obviously, a lot of Democrats don't really want that to be the final budget, so maybe this was a political exercise to sort of open their eyes, you know, open the eyes of the rank and file to the sort of, you know, why some of the leadership thinks these tax increases might be necessary, because this is what the budget would look like without that. And Republicans were reportedly involved in that process, but they're saying there's all this extra money that's come in, and none of the rank and file, Democrats or Republicans, are being consulted on how to use that extra money that's coming to the state government.
Now, Charlie, let me ask you on this, because when we talk about like extra money coming into the state and people look at that and think, hey, happy days are here again, we're talking about a state that still has a huge backlog of bills that it hasn't paid. Some of those stretch back, you know, many months, even years. The state, you shouldn't get too excited right now, should it, when it comes to any type of, you know, short-term windfall that's coming in?
I mean, we should be thankful that we have a short-term windfall, but the notion that, oh, now we don't have to worry about anything else, I think is pretty ludicrous. The reason I say that is the morning of Friday, May 17th, as we're taping the show, the comptroller reported there's a $6.9 billion backlog. These are bills that we owe people for services already rendered for which we don't have the cash to pay. Roughly 86,000 vouchers are backlogged. So the idea that, oh, we don't have to worry about new revenue, I don't think that holds water. And as a matter of fact, the Civic Federation gave kind of conditional support to the budget, a report that came out the other day, and they said that they can support the budget because the governor has decided to use this windfall, so to speak, to not have to stretch out pension payments, not declare a pension holiday. And in my mind, if you want to say, well, we don't need to raise cigarette taxes, we don't need to do some of this other stuff, on the other hand, there's a huge need for a capital program. Because of the constitutional amendment that we passed a couple years ago, we can't take the gas tax and use it to pay for some suburb sewer system. So we'll need a source of revenue. Why not take the cigarette tax and all the other stuff that the governor proposed and use those revenues for a so-called vertical, not roads and bridges, but buildings and infrastructure maintenance that's needed around the state?
Well, Daisy, let me ask you, because the public's appetite is never there for paying higher taxes, of course. And here you've got all of these different taxes coming at people at one time. I think that's the difference now that I see maybe from other years. Often there was, you know, money being talked about, you know, we'll raise this fee or this tax to help fund a capital program or this specific need. But we're talking about a lot of stuff at one time. And the governor's also discussing a graduated income tax that, you know, could possibly pass this year and could be voted on by the public in the 2020 general election and then become law, so it would raise more money that way. It seems to me like, again, that appetite probably isn't there among the public. Can they sell it in the last couple of weeks?
Well, the governor and his administration also not only has that to sell, but also the idea that, well, you know, if we don't want higher taxes, we can turn to legalizing recreational marijuana or legalizing sports betting. People already like to do it. Some people already out there are doing it in the black market. So let's go that route as well. So it's really difficult to say for sure because there are so many moving parts, so many different proposals out there that still haven't really materialized and on how they're actually going to work.
I think another thing to keep in mind is we've talked about how there's only 2 weeks left. But on the other hand, the Democrat supermajority, more important than being able to override the governor, because in my mind, there's no possibility that the Democratic-led legislature is going to pass some bill that Governor Pritzker, a Democrat, is going to veto. That's just not going to happen. On the other hand, having the extra majority means that Democrats alone can pass a budget after May 31st. So if they run over into the beginning of June, they still don't need Republican help if they remain unified.
Don't say that, Charlie. But go ahead, Brian. We can. I don't want to get into
a
long summer
unified,
here.
But that's always a question when it comes to those things like where you have to raise taxes. And I was just going to add, getting to Charlie's earlier point about, you know, well, maybe you don't need these taxes for the budget, you know, the annual operating budget. You can use them for capital. There are also Democrats who want to see these taxes for reasons that have nothing to do with the budget or capital or anything like that, because they want to reduce the use of cigarettes and e-cigarettes, and they want to reduce the use of plastic bags. So these taxes were chosen not only because of the revenue potential, but because they also achieve other democratic aims, such as reducing smoking and reducing the use of plastic bags, for two examples.
This week's Illinois Politics Roundtable included IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield Public Affairs Reporting Program, and a former Chicago Sun-Times reporter, Daisy Contreras, IPR reporter, and Rebecca Enzel, Capital News Illinois, moderated all by Sean Crawford.
We've all had that confused feeling when we wake up. What day is it again? Where are my glasses? A splash of cold water later, things start to make sense. Morning Edition brings your world into focus as you begin your day with stories about politics, culture, and side hustles.
Kersner is hunting for scooters that need to be charged.
It's like Pokemon Go when you make money.
Burn the morning fog away with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University, ranked as 33rd best college for the money by College Factual. Illinois State is also among the best bang for the buck colleges in the Midwest, according to Washington Monthly. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the cuisine of presidents, an inside look. The Bloomington Normal craft beer scene has grown leaps and bounds in the last 2 years. Now, just up the road in Fairbury, Illinois, GLT's Ryan Denham finds a young brewer adding a new flavor to the Central Illinois craft beer corridor.
So these are the beginnings of the hops.
Surrounded by farmland as far as the eye can see, Lincoln Slagle is showing off a crop you don't see too often here in Central Illinois.
And they only actually came out of the ground about a week and a half ago. And as you can see, a couple of them, like over there, that one's already 3.5 feet high.
That crop is hops, as in the flowers used to make beer. Just a few steps away is Slagle's brewery and tap room, Emancipation Brewing Company. It's the latest in a series of craft beer openings in Central Illinois in the past few years. There are now at least 229 craft breweries in Illinois, more than double what it was just 4 years ago. Emancipation comes with the flavor of agritourism, like going to a pumpkin patch, but with, you know, beer.
But I would say the thing that really sets us apart is our kind of, one, our location, which is kind of more of a destination. Even though we're not anywhere glamorous, you know, people come and they spend the whole afternoon here, you know, and it's just kind of a, you know, a little bit of a destination place that, you know, people really have a connection to the agricultural background, I think.
Emancipation is located just outside Fairbury, around an hour northeast of Bloomington Normal. It's literally inside an old dairy barn. On top of what he grows on the vines just outside, Slagle also gets hops from Landlocked Hops. That's just down the road in Loda, Illinois.
A lot of people, when I post on social media about the beer with, like this morning I did about our beer with local hops, you know, people get really excited about it. The locals really want to try it. And those are the most popular releases we've done so far, have been the local ingredient ones. And I think that we've drawn a decent amount of people that are interested in hops. We get a lot of farmers even coming out just to say, hey, you know, we'd like to maybe grow some hops too. You know, it's kind of become a not only a community thing, but, you know, people are coming to it not just because of the beer, which is an interesting thing.
For now, Emancipation's beer is only available here in the tap room. It hasn't popped up in restaurants or stores yet. Slagle has a one-barrel brewing system and 7 fermenters.
Basically, it's as much beer as I can make myself without any help.
Emancipation's tap room is a really clean mix of rustic and modern. A barn door separates the tap room from the brewing area, but then there are power outlets at tables so people can charge their phones. The ag theme is everywhere. When GLT visited, the selection included beer called Row Crop, Farmer's Favorite, and Straw Hat.
We've got a lot of, you know, open space and land here, and we're out back where we grow some of our hops. We're working on kind of a courtyard concept where it won't just be a patio. It'll be a place where families can come and spend the afternoon, play games. There'll be fire pits, things like that. So, you know, something to have, you know, people don't have to just make the trip here and spend a half hour here. They can feel like it's worth it, you know, and have something that the family can kind of enjoy. And so that's, you know, that's our next step. And after that, we're, you know, we've expanded a little bit, got some more tanks and stuff, but it's more to satisfy our demand within the tap room and be able to offer a full range of beers for people to, you know, take home with them.
Slagle is in business with his father, Don. The family's always been entrepreneurial. The other family business is steel fabrication, mostly for agricultural equipment.
So we've always had kind of a small business background, and I grew up around my dad growing his business, and, you know, once I did some internships in college, I kind of just decided that I didn't want to work in the corporate world. I kind of wanted to live in the small business world. Kind of was a perfect timing thing. You know, I got really into brewing, and right at the same time, I needed something to do with my life. So just turned into this.
Well, certainly over the last 10 to 15 years, craft brewing in the U.S. has experienced quite an explosion in growth, and it is fairly mainstream now. I guess, what is your view and what is your read on sort of the trajectory of the industry and where a little guy like you kind of fits into that?
I think that in the near future, and it's already happening now, but I think, you know, you see a lot of growth in small places like us, and you see some kind of a little bit of slowing down in the craft beer industry as a whole, which is interesting since it's still such a small portion of the overall beer market. But the big craft breweries, you know, the nationwide distributing breweries are not doing as well. And I think it's a lot to do with back before Prohibition, and especially you see it in Europe, Germany specifically, there's a small brewery in every town. And the people from the town drink that brewery's beer, and then when they go visit relatives in another town, they drink that town's brewery's beer. And I think it was that way in the United States a lot before Prohibition. We're just now getting to the same amount of breweries that were open before Prohibition in the United States. And to think of how many less people there were then, it really speaks to how much more room there is to grow for new breweries. Now, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of new nationwide breweries, but I think it'll be neat because a lot of little places like this, I think, will keep popping up everywhere. And I hope they do well. I mean, it's a neat thing to go to a small town and visit a place like this. That's one of my favorite things to do when I go other places.
There have been four small breweries that have opened in Bloomington Normal in the last couple of years. One of them ain't so small. It's Distill. But then you have White Oak, and you've got Little Beaver Brewery and Keg Grove. These are all just in the last couple of years have opened in our community. You're not that far away. You're just up the road here, just outside Fairbury. I guess, what is your read on the Central Illinois craft brewing kind of scene? And do you sense that there's opportunities to pick up tourism from people coming through and looking for places like this?
Yeah, I think that, well, for one, the Bloomington craft beer kind of scene is a neat one because I know a lot of those guys personally, and they all help each other out. It's a very unique industry where, those guys have helped me, White Oak and Keg Grove, and those guys have all helped me with stuff, and Little Beaver, and, we don't have much to offer them yet, but hopefully in the future we can repay them. But I think that it's become almost, the breweries kind of band together to draw in people. If there's four breweries in Bloomington, that's going to promote people from Champaign or Peoria or even Chicagoland to make the trip down because it'll be worth it for the day. And we do see a lot of people here from Indiana, Chicago, Bloomington, Iowa. People drive through, driving from Ohio to Oregon and stopped in, just out of nowhere. And I think that, every few people coming into these small towns like that, helps the local. Because they're likely to go out to eat after that and stuff like that. I just think it's neat to drive local business because they all have become destinations.
And at this destination, you don't need to be a craft beer expert to walk in. In fact, it's kind of why it's called Emancipation.
But it turned into, not just freedom from tasteless beer and just the monotony of drinking stuff that you may not even like. It's just more of a habit. It became things like, freedom from the snobbiness that can come oftentimes with the craft beer world, and also just promoting sensible drinking for enjoyment, not for the result. So that freedom from the bad things in beer as well. So we're trying to get the best out of it, I guess.
Emancipation Brewing Company's tap room is open Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. The new outdoor courtyard should be up and running in August or September. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see a photo gallery from GLT's visit to Emancipation right now at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the Coalescence Theater Project gets some love on the national scene. It's not easy to be a chef for the White House. Hundreds of people, many nationalities, many group sizes, and it all has to be high quality. Camp David executive chef Marty Mangiello has cooked for five presidential administrations, along with celebrities and royalty. GLT correspondent Joe Deacon talks with Mangiello at the McLean County Republican Party dinner. Mangiello technically worked for the White House military office. He says even meal planning involves bureaucracy.
We'll usually come up with an idea for menus and then show it to the social secretary and see what they think about it. And, of course, it depends on who's coming to visit. We typically in the United States will honor, say with the menu, half American food and half of the visiting country. And we'll do the same thing with the wines.
What do you do when things don't quite go right? I mean, do guests ever send things back or are not quite as pleased with the reception?
I can honestly say I've never in my life seen a dish come back. But we do have a lot of special requests. You have to be able to control your mind and your hands. So, you're cooking for Muslim specialty requests. You have kosher meals that need to be served that night. You may have any number of a dozen different kinds of diets I've had, everything from Dr. Pritikin to Dr. Ornish, or maybe somebody says, well, I'm on South Beach, and so it's a bit challenging in that regard, but there's certainly no room for any attitude.
What presidents that you've been able to work with are kind of like foodies, and which ones are more finicky or would just kind of rather have a burger or something simple like that?
So I wish I worked with the president who was a chef, okay? And everybody's always like, wow, there was a president who was a chef. I'm like, well, he was also an artist, too. He was very creative. Well, who was that? You're teasing us now. I'm like, actually, President Eisenhower, and he would go up on top of the roof and barbecue with the White House chef. So I wish I had worked with him. And then, you know, these past five presidents I have worked with for 25 years. But also then, you know, I cooked for a king and a queen and many princes and also Prime Minister Hashimoto of Japan and then presidents from other countries. So I often confuse people. I'll say, well, you want to know the presidents I cooked for outside the United States or are you talking about the presidents, like in the president?
I think some people would be interested to know what their appetites were like and things like that.
Absolutely. So they all have their favorites, and figuring that out is the name of the game as quick as you possibly can. So President Reagan loved macaroon cookies. Also, naturally for Reagan, we're going to have jelly beans. And he always had that jar on his desk, the Jelly Belly jar. President Trump's favorite is really the Keebler Vienna Fingers. People naturally, they see that, they know that this is a store-bought cookie. But that is one of Don's favorite cookies. The Vienna Fingers.
What about pork rinds? I think George Bush the first was a big fan of pork rinds.
Absolutely. All that type of food you would expect to find down in the South. We're very famous down there for pork rinds, no matter where you go. So,
can you tell us a little bit how different administrations kind of change the demands on the kitchens?
We have had some chefs fired, so very famous. One of the most famous changes with demands, of course, was you had the Kennedys hired a very famous French chef out of New York, René Verdon, and, you know, spoke barely any English whatsoever. And you've got to constantly all day long go up and get the First Lady because she's the only one who does speak French. And so then you have a new boss all of a sudden, LBJ, and maybe you make the barbecue incorrectly. Maybe you use pork meat and don't realize when he goes into a self-defeating rage spiral that, you know, Texans make their barbecue with beef.
This is Joe Deacon again for Sound Ideas on WGLT, visiting with White House Executive Chef Marty Mangiello. You kind of mentioned how you match the cuisine to visiting heads of state, you know, whether it's a French ambassador or Chinese premier. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, one of my favorites was the Italian state dinner that the United States put on. And since I was raised in an Italian-American family, I would say my grandmother lost her mind on the phone when I called her and said, you know, I'm going to be cooking for Sophia Loren. And she's like, well, why are you cooking for her? What are you doing with her? I'm like, well, Graham, one of the things we do is we have all the famous glitterati in academia, in movies, in, you know, book writers, authors. We go through the whole gamut and we'll invite those people to come in. So she's like, well, who else is going to be there? I was like, well, Joe Gargiola's going to be there, Paul Tagliabue, the NFL commissioner, you know, John Bon Jovi. Who's he? That doesn't sound Italian. I'm like, well, Graham, his real name is Bon Jovi, but he's a famous rock star, Graham. So who else is coming? I'm like, Nicolas Cage is coming. He's not Italian. I'm like, Graham, yes, he is. He is. So those are the kinds of people that come. And that dinner for me was like probably at the top. You know, a 10 out of a 10 for dinners that I cooked for White House state dinners.
Are there other, like, epic failures or things that have gone wrong or other epic successes?
Absolutely. I mean, I still burn food myself. I repeatedly make fun of myself and laugh into my own face. I have over 5,000 students in my cooking school that have graduated, and they say it's so liberating to learn from this guy, the White House chef, who makes fun of himself and making mistakes. So that's really something you have to give yourself a break in the kitchen. You know, I don't measure a lot of stuff. I throw things together. I still burn food, you know.
And so what happens when you do something like that? I mean, do you wind up with a lot more waste than you'd prefer?
Critical difference about me cooking my whole career. I actually will remake the whole food and dish. Some of the chefs that I worked with in the Navy and the military were like, hey, who cares? It's just a bunch of sailors. I'm serving it burnt. But I would not, and sometimes I had to stay later until 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night correcting my mistakes. And my leaders were like, why would you do that? You know, it's just a grubby chow for some swabbies. I'm like, no, it's not. But I would fix my mistakes and correct them.
Tonight's event recognizes several area volunteers for their service. What impresses you about volunteers like these and the work that they do?
You know, it was really amazing when our tribunal reviewed all of the submittals. We had 9 different people here that were submitted, and one of them is actually a whole family, the Kaiser family. We had a tough time. We actually come back, and somebody asked, is it possible to give out 9 gold medals? I mean, honestly, and this particular group, the McLean County Republican Party, I thought did a unique thing. Most of the groups where I do a speech or our people give speeches at worldwide, the group will use that gold medal that we offer for free, which has a serial number and is listed on our website. They'll keep it within their group and award somebody, you know, in the group. This particular group of people decided, no, we don't want to hog that up. We want to open it up to the entire community and celebrate the community. And it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or not. If you're doing great things around here, we want to have you recognized. And so I thought that was really cool.
What can you tell us about the work you're doing at the Presidential Service Center?
Yeah, so we have a bunch of exhibits coming up. One of the most recent exhibits we just had, we had a guest speaker, Orlando Herrera, came down and did his whole speech in a fireside chat related to Rosa Parks and Claudette Colvin and that entire Alabama bus boycott in Montgomery and all of his research from the Library of Congress. And so that was a massive exhibit that had just opened and was all completed in December. So these are some of the exhibits that we have in the museum. And some of them are in glass, obviously, to see things, but then we do the live streaming and fireside chats. And, you know, we also get out of town and come to events like this around the United States.
And so what are some of your fondest memories of being the executive chef to the president?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, just the responsibility of being in the military and realizing at 8 o'clock tonight you don't get to take the white coat off and go home. That's for the civilian chefs to do. Because in the military, you turn into a bartender at night. And so literally this is like, you know, you're watching Game of Thrones and the person walks up to the king or the queen with the silver chalice and says, here it is, your highness, go on ahead, it's safe to drink. And he's like, really? Let me see you drink from it. No, your highness, I just tried it. No, drink from it right now in front of me. So it's really important that the people that we have around the presidency in the White House military office have a very, very expensive and long investigation. It's nothing that you would be allowed to come to work within the first month and start working in the Oval Office. The people who are playing with food and doing your housekeeping, your valet duties, they're around the nuclear briefcase all the time, you're a butler, you can put the white coat on and prepare my dinner tonight for, you know, Melania and Barron and I, or maybe we're having 300, you know. I don't know. I didn't make up my mind yet, but that number would often go up and down throughout the day. It could be 40, it could go up to 80, it could go right back down to 3 around 6 o'clock. It's just going to be mommy, daddy, and baby.
So you have to be pretty flexible then.
Absolutely. Flexible like Gumby. Yeah.
What are some of your own personal favorite meals or foods or tastes?
So mine kind of moves all around because I'm a real foodie. But I love a Floridian fusion cuisine, yeah. And this is a blending of Caribbean and fruits and citrus. And, of course, you have all the seafood mixed in with that, black beans and rice and things. So, yeah, but I grew up in an Italian household with a lot of screaming and yelling. And at every Thanksgiving, there had better be a platter of ravioli or there's going to be a systemic revolt.
GLT correspondent Joe Deacon talking with White House Executive Chef Marty Mangiello, who now oversees the Presidential Resource Center in Grover, North Carolina. He presented Distinguished Service Awards to the David and Bob Kaiser families for their work in the Midwest Food Bank and to Normal Police Detective Nicole Bruno for her volunteerism with the Special Olympics, PATH, and the Police Union. We'll be right back. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington's Coalescence Theater Project is one of 12 companies selected to present at the National American Association of Community Theater Festival. The theater will present Walking with My Ancestors in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania next month. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with Coalescence Theater Project's artistic director Don Shandro and the play's writer and performer Anna Ama Oforiwa Adonam.
Walking with My Ancestors is based on field research that I conducted. I actually started this research in 2008. But this particular performance is about my journeys through the slave dungeons at Cape Coast Castle in Ghana. I wanted to understand and to ask questions of the spirits in those spaces to help me cope with some issues that I was going through.
Would you be willing to perform a small piece of that for us?
Yes, I'd like to. I'd love to. So what I'd like to perform is a part of the play where I am at Cape Coast Castle, and I'm confronting the castle for its role in harboring the enslaved Africans. So here we go. Cape Coast Castle, yes, you. I am here to confront you. Cape Coast Castle, Oguakoto, Akotojujiba Wada Huntuano. Yes, you, I'm talking to you. You big white with blood on your hands. You kept captured, shackled, proud Africans for months, delivered them onto boats across the Atlantic to plantations in the Americas. I have come to live with you. Mondays, Thursdays, 4 hours each time for 5 months. I will sit alone in your dark, damp coals underground, in my dirty clothes, sleep deprived, full bladder, hungry, shackled. I will enter your womb.
Could you explain a little bit to us what that specific piece means to you?
Right, so here, I went to Cape Coast Castle again to understand and to cope with and to have some answers for some things that I was going through in my life here in America. And so I went to Cape Coast Castle, and I get there and I see this massive structure, right, that was part of my ancestors' enslavement. Because what happened in these tombs, I call them tombs, but also they are also wombs as well, because the Africans were buried there and then they came out as enslaved Africans and they just changed who they were and their identity. So I am in the space and I'm looking at this big, massive structure and I'm upset, I'm angry, and I'm confronting it for its role in enslaving my ancestors. So I'm angry, I'm confronting it, and I'm talking about how I was going to confront it. And my way of confronting it is basically sitting in there for 5 months, 4 hours each time, Mondays and Thursdays, and telling this massive structure how I was going to do that. I was going to do that in my dirty clothes, shackled, full bladder, hungry, and just sit. And sit there. And try to confront it and try to understand what the ancestors went through when they were there for all those months. So I'm angry, but I'm also sad. I'm frustrated because in my mind, whatever I was experiencing in or whatever I'm experiencing in this current contemporary time is connected to what they went through in those dungeons. And so going there was my way to understand how to deal with whatever I was going through in society.
The play itself becomes a kind of ceremony where she goes through that whole process to come to terms with herself and her experience as someone from Ghana who lives in this country.
Now, Don, one of Coalescence Theater Project's main goals is to tell the world's unheard stories. So how does Walking with My Ancestors fit into that?
Oh my goodness, it's right where we need to be. It's a story about an immigrant experience. It's a story about an international experience. It's about a show about our connection in this country with a global experience. It speaks so much to what we are as an organization and what we want to do.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen, speaking with Don Shandro and Ama Oforiwa Adunam of Bloomington's Coalescence Theater Project. Walking with My Ancestors was entered into the Region 3 American Association of Community Theater Festival, where it fared rather well. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. We won the top spot. We won Outstanding Production. Oforiwa won the Outstanding Leading Performer. Kim Pereira, the director, won Outstanding Direction. And we are one of 12 theater companies from across the country that are going to be performing in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
And so performing in Gettysburg, that's the national stage, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. It's very exciting. I'm nervous, but I think it's a great place to really share this story because Gettysburg, for it's just symbolic for what Gettysburg stands for, right? Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg speech was right there. So taking this play up there is just, you know, a play that talks about slavery and enslavement and the conditions of, you know, what slavery did to our society and still, and it still has an impact. Slavery does still have an impact on our society today, you know. So it really takes us back, but it also is able to make connections with the present.
It's all of the connections have been really kind of exciting because here we are, a Central Illinois theater company that has been selected to perform a play about the repercussions of slavery from its very inception in the slave dungeons of Ghana here in the United States, in the Americas. And it's going to be performed in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And it's going to be performed on June the 18th, which is the eve of Juneteenth, the day before Juneteenth, the commemoration of the end of slavery. So we're in the right place, doing the right thing at the right time.
The Illinois representative for the American Association of Community Theater called Walking with My Ancestors profoundly impacting and immediately relevant. So why is the play's message so important right now?
Well, for me, I think it is important because of what is, there's so much going on in our community, in our world, in our society that I think that the play addresses, right? We're talking about police brutality, we're talking about discrimination, we're talking about immigration and the impact of, the whole debate about immigration and what do we do with families and separating children and, you know, all those things are so important. And I think this play addresses all these issues on so many different levels. And so everyone can connect, you know, with the story.
It really connects on a really basic human level. Oforiwa had the audience in tears at the performance in Kokomo, Indiana, at the regionals, because it does connect with really the pain of this country, with an emotional rift that's unhealed and has continued to be unhealed, and this. Just seeing this play can be part of that healing process, I'm hoping.
The performance brought home various awards, like we discussed earlier, Outstanding Actor, Outstanding Direction, Outstanding Overall Production. And the theater is one of 12 companies to move on to the national stage. So, Don, what does it mean to you to see the theater doing so well?
This is really exciting. It's been an exciting year for us. We actually started as a theater company in March of 2018. And we performed our first play at the Normal Theater. It was a play called Seven, about seven really very important women from around the world and their unique voices in human rights. And we've done a production called A Dying Breed, written by a local playwright, Ian Field Stewart, who is now in New York writing. We've had a joint project where we were the community connection with the Crossroads Project at Illinois State University's Theater Department production of God. We've worked with the Social Work Department at ISU. We're going to be developing a project with Chestnut Health Systems and Joy Care. And then to top it all off, we're selected to perform at the Nationals in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. So to me, it's like open doors all along the way for us. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting. Where we started in March of last year, well, really actually January of last year, when we started talking about doing what we're doing, to where we are right now.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Don Shandro and Amma Oforiwa Adonam with the Coalescence Theater Project. The theater will present another local showing of Walking with My Ancestors in August. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Mary Cullen, Ryan Denham, and correspondent Joe Deacon. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.